The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In December of 1931, a group of men and women were arrested at the Heart of New York Gymnasium for exercising in the buff. 24 seized in raid on nudist cult, read the New York Times headline. Shortly after, the same newspaper reported that Judge Jonah Goldstein dismissed the charges against the so-called cult, stating that what is all right on the beach today would have meant arrest 3 years ago. The story kicks off Brian Hoffman's book, Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism, which is now out on Kindle. We spoke with him when the book was first published. So your book is about American nudism, but nudism as a movement was largely exported to the U.S. from Germany. So give us a story there.
Sure. So in Germany, this has been happening as part of a larger movement called Lebensreform, which is this kind of return to nature. They believed in natural healing, they're against alcohol consumption, and they also believe that going naked was a way to return to nature.
And when was this?
1905 is, I think, the way most historians mark it, and it definitely is kind of what sparks these nudist camps that both develop in the German countryside, but also in the urban areas.
So what was going on in America in the late 20s and early 30s when this Heart of New York Gymnasium raid took place? What kind of cultural forces were paving the way for American nudism at that time?
In America, you're seeing this like gradual shift away from the moral absolutism of the 19th century, that the discussion of sex had to really be kept secret or repressed. This is moving away. We're starting to see a greater acceptance of birth control, of kind of titillating films. Books dealing with controversial subjects are now being accepted. And so with this shift away from kind of sexual repression, you see people kind of open up to the idea of nudism in the United States. You start seeing books of travel narratives from Americans who have visited German camps become very popular. And then you have kind of German immigrant groups wanting to recreate the Nackt culture experience that they had enjoyed in Germany.
Nackt culture?
Nackt culture is like basically culture of the nude.
Mm-hmm.
And so they start developing these very small groups in kind of immigrant communities, New York City, Chicago. In America, though, it expands beyond that. So it becomes kind of a phenomenon where you have people from all walks of life choosing to go naked as a way of combating shame in America, but also promoting health.
Mm-hmm. This is at a time when there were a lot of reactionary movements to industrialism and urbanization in American life.
So yes, during the Progressive Era, there's a great deal of concern about diseases of darkness, things like rickets or tuberculosis. Doctors would all the time send people out west to places like New Mexico and Arizona to have that dry climate, the exposure to the sun. So nudists build on that by removing the clothes in nudist camps, in gymnasiums. They not only soak up the sun and get vitamin D production going, which is supposed to be good for all different sorts of things, but also removing the clothes, allowing the glands, the sweat glands, to do what they're naturally supposed to do. And this becomes quite popular as nudists practice it, but also in the medical profession, and in hospitals would have solariums. So it's that kind of idea that the sun is a cure, that it is therapeutic, that allows nudists to kind of appeal to a whole segment of American society that's interested in natural healing and alternative medicine.
So that's what's going on socially. How about legally? What was the landscape for nudism in the 1930s?
Definitely legal history is part of what makes nudism possible. The American Civil Liberties Union are trying to open up expression in the United States, especially in the first decades of the 20th century. And nudism becomes part of that struggle. the first thing that kind of falls is like books with literary and scholarly merit, which is what really allows nudist books to be on the open market in the United States. But they do become embroiled in other cases because they walk this fine line of what is and isn't acceptable, what is illicit and what is respectable. And actually, that's one of the fascinating things to me about this movement. There are people who are sincerely about health and combating shame, but then there are others who are about also promoting the eroticism of the naked body to make a quick buck. But the line is never clear. And I think it speaks to the way Americans kind of understand the naked body, which is it has these contradictory and multiple functions of being about health and beauty and aesthetics, but also about eroticism and pornography. And so that line is a question that really challenges the courts from really the time nudism begins in the early 1930s all the way into the 1960s and 70s.
Well, let's talk about making a buck. Central to the nudism movement was this flagship magazine. It was called Sunshine and Health.
Yes.
Now, this is something that people gravitated toward because it did have, you know, photographs of naked people. But first, how important was this publication to organizing and actually promoting American nudism?
Yeah, it was really essential to putting nudism on the map in the United States. After these books kind of run their course, it's the magazine that allows the early nudist organizations to communicate about camps, about their philosophy, about what's happening in the movement. It is their internet of the day. So it was critical to establishing the movement in the United States. And the man who's really behind it is this guy. He's a fascinating character, the Reverend Illy Boone. And he is really critical to these magazines, fighting for the legal right to publish them, and then promoting them. They're really actually pretty beautiful magazines. They have wonderful covers. They're really highly and well produced. But what you end up seeing is this kind of imbalance of pictures. Like on the cover, very attractive, usually female, sometimes families. And in the inside, you see this assortment of pictures that is much more, how do you say, honest to the nudist lifestyle.
Yeah, the post office didn't even want to deliver these magazines. I'm speaking with Brian Hoffman. He's author of the book Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism, which traces nudism from its roots in Germany to the rise of the family nudist resort and much beyond. So there is this undeniably erotic aspect to nudism. Now, how did that start to shape public perception about nudism during and after World War II, when there was a general sort of liberalization of the culture?
During the Second World War, because you have so many troops in all-male environments away from home, they become much more accepting of things like pinups.
Right. Betty Grable is at everyone's bunk, right?
Yes, everyone. All these actresses, pinups everywhere, on airplanes, all over the place. And it's part of accepted is the culture. And so you get these reports from soldiers writing into Sunshine Health thanking them for making such a wonderful magazine that's circulating around the barracks. And the nudists reprint this in their magazines, and they're proud to be part of this war effort. It not only allows the nudist movement to kind of to support itself during the war through these magazines, but after the war, people are aware of the camps, and they want to see them. And so when they come back, you see an explosion of membership in nudist camps that I think is really growing out of the exposure nudism gained through the armed forces.
But you also have what you call the single man problem at these nudist resorts. Now, what is that exactly?
The single man problem definitely grows out of this popularity that these nudist magazines had during the Second World War. You get a lot of single men coming to these camps. But single men, they are somewhat suspect. They could be there to soak up the sun. On the other hand, they could also be there as voyeurs. They can be there to be looking for sexual, you know, trysts. They could be there to check out other men. And this was something that was a constant tension at many nudist camps, especially as they saw their membership skew heavily male. Mm-hmm. And it kind of threatened what nudism was all about during this period, which is about the family and being heteronormative.
But it sounds kind of like a precursor to the kind of problems that many, you know, clubs have, nightclubs have had through the ages, and now dating sites are coping with very heavily male skewed.
Yes, absolutely. Like, these things attract the attention of men. And nudism was no exception, definitely a precursor to those kind of things where you have bars that, you know, attract women with, you know, free drinks and dating sites that give women extra freebies. I think, you know, whereas men have to pay for certain things, women don't have to pay to access different accounts. And nudist clubs were doing the same thing, that they would offer cheaper memberships for women or more expensive memberships for single men, that they had to carry their weight if they weren't bringing their family with them. In New Hampshire, there's Cedars Waters Village, and they still only allow couples. Mm-hmm. Like, that is their rule. Only men can come with when they're accompanied with women. That is largely faded from most camps nowadays. It's much more open. This is a privately held camp, and they've been around since 1950. And they're holding on to those kind of rules that were established in this post-war period.
Well, you know, I've been hearing about that camp my entire life growing up in New Hampshire. I think we all sort of get this idea about it, and it's, you know, tinged with this sense of illicitness. But you spoke to the kind of heteronormative formation of these camps, especially at that time. This was liberalization, I guess, on some level, but not quite. Still very family-centric. What was there a tension there?
Yes, there's an acceptance now that, you know, people have sex. You know, it is part of life. Men and women, people accept the dating culture. They accept that they're going to go to the movies, that there's this petting culture before marriage. But as long as that's kind of contained within the male-female relationship between marriage, ultimately resulting in a family and normalcy, then in American society, that type of sexuality is fine. What's not accepted are things that go against the grain, such as homosexual relationships, interracial intimacy, and a real kind of elephant in the room is the intergenerational sexuality or pedophilia, child molestation. These things raise major concerns, both within nudism, but also outside, people looking in at camps, like what's going on behind those walls, those fences.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're revisiting my earlier conversation with Brian Hoffman, author of Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism, which is now available on Kindle. How about the sexual revolution and the sort of hippie and free love movement in the 1960s? How did that change nudist culture?
Yes, the counterculture 1960s, it is really interesting. It's one of the things I enjoyed writing most about this book, is how fractured the movement becomes during this period. In the 1960s, there's this new generation that wants to use nudity, and specifically public nudity, to challenge what they see as being the hypocritical values of American society. So they no longer want to confine themselves to these camps. They want to be on the beach. They want to be in the park. And they want to have the right to kind of unclothe and to undress where and when they want as a way of being authentic. This is what the nudist movement then becomes, is this like loose assortment of organizations and groups and people that is much more confrontational about public nudity in a lot of different spaces. These nudists, these new generation of counterculture kind of hippies going naked, definitely conflict with an older generation that is much more about respectability and is not comfortable with the kind of erotic implications of the naked body.
So this is an academic book, and we never really get a sense of how you, Brian Hoffman, feel about nudism. So what made you want to write about this subject? Are you a nudist yourself?
Sure. I'm not a nudist. I actually think that's important. There's been a lot of people that have written from inside the movement and have provided us hagiographies of the movement, and those are fantastic. But I also thought it was good to have, like, step back and look at this movement as a historian. My personal interest, and it kind of comes from like unresolved questions of my own childhood, I think. I grew up with parents who were definitely hanging on to the counterculture a little bit too long. As a child, I was let free to roam the backyard completely naked. I grew up in this kind of funky neighborhood in Los Angeles called Mount Washington, and we would have block parties, and those were definitely clothing optional. And it was part of my childhood, going naked. In our photo album, there's all sorts of pictures that, you know, you probably don't want to show your girlfriend. But as I grew older, I realized that not everyone, all families were like this, that this was sort of odd. And this kind of, when I got into grad school and I was looking what to study, it was this question of why do Americans have this uncomfortable relationship with the body? You know, why is it so linked with shame? Why was my childhood so different? And I think as I stumbled across these nudist materials, it was a really great opportunity to answer that question, to use this kind of marginal oddball movement to look at how Americans have thought about the body, you know, over the course of the 20th century.
But how about today in this kind of super sexualized culture, a nude resort for adults anyway, seems almost, I don't know, quaint or for, you know, oddballs, I guess, might be the reputation that goes on. But then again, there are still campaigns to free the nipple, you know, debates over public breastfeeding and laws that continue to make public nudity a criminal act. So has our culture's relationship with nudity changed all that much?
You know, I've been following the Free the Nipple campaign and a lot of the different things going on.
Maybe you should first tell people what it is, because I'm not sure everyone knows.
Sure. So there's been an effort by celebrities, but also everyday people, that women should have the right to kind of display their bodies in the same way a man is generally able to display his chest or torso, whether they're on the beach or in their homes, or really it's on Facebook or Instagram. And what you're seeing is a different conversation emerging about what should and shouldn't be seen. We're no longer talking about judges or the government saying it's wrong or illegal to display your breasts on Facebook. It's Mark Zuckerberg. And I think that's different. When we are producing the content, when we are deciding to display it, and we decide who our friends are, we feel that no company should tell us what we can and cannot show. So I think that's really different. The other thing that's going on, I think, in American society or even in the world, is the digitization of life has made us much more comfortable displaying our bodies. We take selfies now. These selfies are often of us on clothes. And because we don't have to worry about bringing them in to be developed anywhere, that they're ours, they're private, we keep them on our phones or on our computers, we've become comfortable with seeing our naked bodies and showing them. I don't think nakedness is as big a deal, especially for the younger digitized generation. And it's something that nudists have embraced. It's actually as strong a movement as it's ever been. It's a $400 million industry that is kind of accepting a tremendous growth in its membership at this point. There's all sorts of events, you know, naked cycling movements and Free the Nipple, naked protests all the time. When I was in San Francisco, the Castro was having this debate about people going naked on the street there. And it wasn't a debate about completely banning it, but like having them bring their towels when they sit down. So I do think things are shifting quite dramatically. The fact that these things are going on is, I think, a reflection that people's attitudes are changing.
Brian Hoffman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was my earlier conversation with the author Brian Hoffman. We first spoke when his book Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism was published in 2015. The book is now available for Kindle. Coming up, we take a ride with the Bee Police. It's a task force of scientists charged with investigating bee deaths, one hive at a time.
On a spring afternoon, Pam was out in her own field chopping buckwheat when she saw a tractor across the road, ready to do the planting. She noticed the winds were blowing toward her property, and she started to get a bad feeling.
So I checked on the beehives within a few hours of the corn being planted. And at that point, there were piles of dead bees in front of each of our hives.
That story, when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. One of the most popular genres in television is the police procedural, the CSI, NCIS, Law and Order. You know what I'm talking about. Well, this next story from producer Megan Multeni takes the police procedural format in a new direction by focusing on crimes against, well, we'll let you find out for yourself.
It's a golden fall day in Scandia, Minnesota, a rural farming community on the banks of the St. Croix River. The fields are full of yellow corn, 6 feet tall, and ready to be harvested. It's beautiful in that tidy Midwestern sort of way. But for a pair of beekeepers, this scene suggests something more sinister. To understand why, we'll journey into a state laboratory and explore a lineup of molecules. But first, we have to go back to a Friday afternoon in May.
My name is Pam Arnold. I am one of the managers here at Salt and Pepper Farm. I live here. I've been keeping bees for quite a few years, 13 years.
Pam and her friend Christy Allen have 5 hives each. The spot is ideal for bees, protected by trees, surrounded by flowering goldenrod and clover. But beyond the bounds of the property, it's corn, as far as you can see. On a spring afternoon, Pam was out in her own field chopping buckwheat when she saw a tractor across the road, ready to do the planting. She noticed the winds were blowing toward her property, and she started to get a bad feeling.
So I checked on the beehives within a few hours of the corn being planted, and at that point, there were piles of dead bees in front of each of our hives.
She had seen insects die after corn planting before, but this time was different. The effect on her bees was immediate, and it was, well, dramatic.
Thousands of dying bees, and then behaving oddly, on their backs, flailing their legs, spinning around, trying to clean off their bodies.
So Pam called Christy to tell her what was going on.
Because I had been through this, so I...
Back in 2013, one of Christy's hives got hit with a pesticide called fipronil, used to keep termites away from buildings. By the time she showed up, more than 20,000 bees were already dead. She lost the hive, and she never found out who did it. To Christy, this was not okay. She wanted a way to hold someone accountable, whoever had sprayed the fipronil. So she talked to legislators, she sat in on committee sessions, she lobbied. And 4 months later, there was a new law on the books. It did 2 things. It made Minnesota the only state in the country to compensate beekeepers if they lost a hive due to someone else's errant spraying. And it created a task force of scientists to investigate these acute pesticide kills. Like a police forensic unit, this team traces the chemical culprit back to its human source. They're the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's bee team.
My name is Jameson Scholler, and I'm an entomologist.
My name is Matt Jorgensen. I'm an agricultural investigator.
And I'm John Peckham. I'm the manager of our inspection enforcement section.
Christy and Pam called the bee team when they found their bees dying. This was on a Friday afternoon. The next Monday, these guys showed up to figure out what happened. And I should say at this point that the Department of Agriculture wouldn't provide me with specifics about Pam or Christy's cases, because they are both still open and under investigation. So any details about what happened next comes from the beekeepers.
3 people came representing the Department of Ag. Each had a slightly different specialty. They asked us some questions.
Have you been treating for varroa mites? What sorts of...
Basically, they want to rule out other possible suspects. To find out what happened, the investigators next gather clues. And bees. Live bees go into jars and onto ice, so any pesticides in their bodies stay preserved. Dead bees get measured by volume, giving a sense for the overall death toll. 1 cup equals about 1,000 bees, which is the number you need to qualify as an acute kill.
And that's a level that indicates a threshold of damage that the colony may or may not be able to bump back.
This is probably as good a place as any to talk about colony collapse disorder, or CCD. Most people know bees aren't doing very well and that CCD is largely to blame. But while scientists don't know exactly what causes it, some mix of disease, lack of food, pesticide exposure, parasites, they do know the symptoms. And they look very different from what Pam and Christy saw on that Friday in May. With colony collapse, the bees disappear suddenly. They all leave one day and they don't come back. Which is why when Christy and Pam saw piles of dead bees, they suspected a pesticide. But before the Department of Agriculture could determine a culprit, the sample had to be analyzed.
We're in the second floor pesticide lab.
This is Gary Horvath, the lab manager at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in St. Paul. This is where Pam and Christy's bees came for chemical analysis.
My name is Yoko Johnson. I'm a supervisor for the environmental analysis unit.
In the lab, Yoko grinds up the bees and mixes them with some liquid and salt. Then they get spun around in a centrifuge to extract out any pesticides that might be present into a few drops of clearish liquid. And in this liquid is the answer to the question of what killed Pam and Christy's bees. Now we just need a gas chromatography mass spectrometry machine.
I'm gonna start this.
Yoko turns on a machine that kind of looks like a big white microwave. It starts heating up to 250 degrees. This turns the sample into a gas. A sticky coating on a coil inside the machine separates out all the chemicals in this gas, including any pesticides that might be present. Then, the machine breaks up the different chemicals and weighs them. Each one leaves behind a unique signature. In forensic metaphors, this is our smoking gun.
The mass spectral response, the way it fragments, is like a fingerprint of the chemical you're looking for.
And like running a set of prints against a criminal database, the offending chemical is lined up with the Department of Agriculture's molecular library.
This is the chromatogram.
Yoko points at a computer screen. The monitor shows a series of sharp peaks, some tall, some short.
These peaks represent each substance. If you click it, so you can visually see it matches.
So just like that, we can know exactly which chemical is to blame. For Christy and Pam, that chemical was a pesticide called clothianidin. In the U.S., it's sold under the name Poncho 600.
There are certain levels that the EPA considers toxic to bees, and ours was on the lower side, but can still impact them.
Clothianidin belongs to a class of pesticides known as neonicotinoids because of how chemically similar they are to nicotine. They're used in about 95% of U.S. corn and soy crops. Most often, they're incorporated in seed coatings to protect the seed from hungry insects while it's in the ground during the plant's early life. But researchers have found that the pesticide could come off as a dust and drift onto other plants, plants that bees like. This is how Christy and Pam believe their bees brought home the poison that would eventually kill them. Not all of Pam's bees died following the pesticide hit, but she says the ones that lived haven't been the same since.
These bees are not defensive, they're lackadaisical. They haven't put up any honey.
There's another hive, too, one that Pam was tending for a friend, providing it with pollen and sugar water. Those bees weren't out foraging on the day of the corn planting, so they actually serve as a kind of control. And that hive? It's doing very well. 3 months after the incident, there isn't yet any closure for either Christy or Pam. For now, their cases remain open. Pesticide investigators like Matt continue to dig through records, interview neighboring farmers, and look at weather logs. Since 2014, when the compensation law was passed, there have been 10 investigations, including Pam and Christie's. No one has yet been compensated. And while it might be poetic for Christy to be the first person to benefit from a law she helped write, she's not holding her breath.
The investigation may or may not be able to prove that I had an acute pesticide poisoning as defined by this compensation law. But it's not about the dollars, it's about the fact that this is the system that we're in. And there's been multiple days this summer where I just, like, I'm banging my head against a beehive and I'm like, why am I doing this? You know, because you can go into a hive and everything looks beautiful and normal, and then the next day it's like, what happened?
Whatever happens with Christy's investigation, it's already become an important data point for her as she tries to make sense of the losses. Lately, a picture has started to emerge. This year, her best hives were across the river in Wisconsin, where it's too hilly for industrial agriculture. The worst ones were in southern Minnesota, surrounded by corn. She admits it may not be strictly scientific, but it's information she'll use next year to try to give her bees their best shot at surviving. But for Pam, moving her bees isn't an option. This is their home. and it's her home too.
The privilege of living in an environment where all these things are visible to us is counterbalanced by this sort of growing awareness that we're watching it end. Because what's affecting our bees is affecting the birds, is affecting the water. How do we measure the systemic impact of these acute situations?
It's a good question, a complex one that we don't really understand just yet. Lab studies don't do a good job of replicating real life, and causation outside the lab is tricky to prove because it's so uncontrolled. But some answers are beginning to come out. In the summer of 2015, British scientists showed that honeybee die-offs were linked to neonicotinoid seed treatments, the same stuff that Christy and Pam suspect killed their bees. Now, similar studies are underway in the US. Bees pollinate 90% of the world's food crops, so if the pesticides we use really are killing them off, bees might not be the only species losing out.
And that story came to us from Megan Multeny as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Humans love dogs. A quick search on Amazon's bookstore reveals more than 31,000 entries. Training books, breeding books, inspirational dog-related novels, and nonfiction essays. But for everything written about Canis lupus familiaris, very little attention is paid to the planet's most common variety. I'm not talking about a particular breed. I'm talking about the street and village dogs that some say make up 75% of the estimated 1 billion dogs around the globe. Raymond and Lorna Coppinger have studied these village dogs in dumps and cities across the world. Raymond was a founding professor of biology at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, and Lorna is a biologist and science writer. Their new book is called What is a Dog? Lorna, I'm going to start with you. What is a dog turns out is a much more complicated question than I ever thought. So let's start with this. What is a village dog?
A village dog is one of those dogs that live in a village, or some villages are actually cities, but they live free. They're not owned by anybody in particular. They're not fed by anybody in particular, but they find their food among the detritus that people leave behind.
They're typically about 30 pounds, maybe a little less as you get close to the equator or as you go away from the equator. They get bigger. The interesting part about them is that they've been around forever. I mean, if you go back and you read Homer, you read the Iliad, you read the Odyssey, you find Homer obsessed with dogs. He's always talking about village dogs. They're scavengers. They eat everything, and including corpses. And that's another common theme in the Bible, is that these dogs are out there. They're scavengers of the villages or the cities, where the vultures are the scavengers of the field.
So we have a long historical record of this village dog. But you argue in the book that the village dog is the true essence of a dog. What sets it apart from our pets and what we think of as the mongrels or strays or feral dogs?
I think the interesting part about that question is that we regard these dogs as mongrels or strays or whatever, and they're not. They're the original dog. And if you look at your pet class dogs, they all come from village dogs. People didn't select pointers or Labrador retrievers or any of those other dogs. They didn't select them from wolves. They selected them from village dog populations, and it still happens today.
This is a dog that if you went back 2,000 years or even more, this is an animal you would find. There would not be any purebreds running around. There would be this 35 or 45-pound tawny color, short-haired dog with a curly tail and maybe sticky-up ears, and they'd be all over the place, and they're the original dogs.
You're pointing, Lorna, now to the origins of the dog. It's been commonly believed that human beings first domesticated the dogs. The two of you regard that as very human-centric way of looking at dogs and propose that dogs and probably a lot of other animals domesticated themselves.
Absolutely. It's we're always looking for the origin of the dog as if people did it. But people didn't do it. Ever since the 50s and 60s, when people began to study something called domestication, the scientists realized that all of these animals, cows, sheep, goats, pigs, whatever, were crop pests, or they were scavengers off human society. And so as these animals adapted to that new agricultural niche that humans were creating, all of a sudden somebody finds out, wow, it's easier to fence them in than it is to fence them out.
So dogs then domesticated themselves, we're talking then 8, 10,000 years ago, with the origins of agriculture among human beings. Do we know where they came from?
Who knows? People sit there and try to find the date that they first took the first wolf puppy out of the den. And that's all silliness. I mean, it just is silly as that. There's no such thing as an Adam and Eve dog. So I go with 5,000 years. My colleagues all push me and say, you got to go back a little bit. Okay, when do you first see them on walls of caves and buildings and whatever else? 7,000 years ago. I'll give you 7.
Well, Lorna, early in the book, you write that the man's best friend phrase is distressingly overused. Lorna, what do you think? This Western view we have of the dogs here in the U.S., does that cloud our ability to really understand these animals?
The relationship between people and dogs is extremely complex. I tend to think that the dog is man's best friend. My lovely husband doesn't like the phrase at all.
Ray, what's your opposition to that phrase, man's best friend?
It changes with time. For example, if you look at organizations like humane organizations, ASPCA, when did they start? They started in the 19th century, and what was the animal that they focused on? The horse. All right, there was this terrible abuse of horses going on in places like New York City and other cities and so forth where horses were used as a draft animal and so on. And back in the 19th century, everybody thought, the horse is a man's best friend. When did dogs first start to get mentioned? After World War II. And where did they first start to get mentioned? In the places that all of a sudden were developing dog food, were developing veterinary services for dogs, were developing.
Well, I'm glad
I got a question for you.
Yes.
All right, so how many dogs does the Queen have?
Oh, I don't know. She has a bunch of corgis, doesn't she? Probably
yeah,
6.
Yeah, 5. How many pigeons does she have?
Geez, I can't answer that for you, Ray.
Oh, she not only has 100-odd pigeons as pets, but they're different breeds. It's just one of those definitional questions. Man's best friend is meant to sell dog food.
That's Ray Coppinger. He and his wife, Lorna Coppinger, are longtime dog scientists and authors of What is a Dog?, which, among other things, takes a very deep dive into the perhaps 750 million village dogs that populate dumps and cities and villages all over the world. I'm glad you brought up animal cruelty and treatment because, you know, again, going back to this idea with the village dog, a dog that in some cities is hunted and shot or caught and euthanized, how do your ideas about village dogs fit into our notions of humane treatment of animals? Are they aligned, at odds? I mean, does the question even apply?
Humane treatment, as usually traditionally applied to animals that were work animals, like horses or cows or even dogs that were work animals. And so it focused on people who were abusing animals that they had trained to work for them. The problem when you get out to these village dogs in the cities and the streets and so forth, they're adapted to a niche, and they live in that niche, and they take the resources from the niche. The problem with that argument is the Darwinian argument is that all animals over-reproduce, and that most of them have to starve to death. You look at a population in a city, and you got these wonderful 50% of the population are these fat little puppies, and the other 50% of the population are most of the time pretty good-looking adults. But that age group in between, the juvenile, most of them are going to starve to death. I hate to tell you this, but that's normal.
Well, Ray, I know you spent a lot of time in dumps researching the book, and you're talking about how advantageous it would be for a village dog to hang around with people who are going to feed him. So talk a little bit, please, about that relationship that humans have with dogs at the dump and how that helped inform your ideas about the village dog.
I've actually taught courses in the Mexico City dump.
In the dump?
In the dump. I take the class down to Mexico and get a hotel, and we spend 2 weeks in the dump studying dogs. And the interesting difference, say, between dogs and something like wolves, wolves are adapted to hunting and catching prey. And so they have a size and a shape to do it. Dogs are a lot smaller, and what they do is they sit somewhere and wait for food to come to them. So whether it's dead mangoes or lettuce or chickens or whatever else that end up in the dump, that's what they're doing. Female dogs have their puppies in and around a village and so on, and then there's this, the little puppy goes in and solicits care from a human being somewhere. Or in many places in the world, they solicit care from sheep or goats or whatever, so that they sit and they hang around the flock, or they sit and hang around people and wait for food to come to them. I think that's the most interesting thing of all, is that it's not the people that are doing it, it's the dog that's doing it.
Has this study of the village dog and your conclusion or your argument that this is the essence of dog changed your relationship or made you think differently about your relationship with dogs?
Are you going to answer that, Lauren, or am I?
No, you're going to answer that one, Ray.
All right. Starting with Aristotle, people tried to define a species. And Aristotle defined a species as an essence. You know one when you see one. You know, rabbits have an essence. You look at that and you say it's a rabbit. And we always thought that those village dogs out there, that was the essence of dogs. You look at that and you say, that's a dog.
And you look at a Pomeranian and you say, that's a dog?
Oh, you're going to get into trouble. Yeah. But anyway, that is one of the most puzzling problems for scientists right now as they try to go and they try to define what a species is. And I think the geneticists are the worst ones at it. You know, is a species a population of animals that is reproductively isolated from all others? That's what I learned when I was a little kid in paleontology class. Or is it, as the ecologists say, it's an animal that's adapted to a niche? Well, goodness, the dog is adapted to a very, very different niche than is something that we call the Arctic gray wolf. It's like the old poem says, and around we go we.
Well, I think you're going to get us in a little bit of trouble here, Ray Coppinger with Geneticist, but I thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay. I don't mind getting in trouble.
I have that feeling.
All right.
Ray and Lorna Coppinger, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yes, thank you for inviting us.
Ray and Lorna Coppinger, authors of What is a Dog? You can read much more about the book and read a terrific profile of the Coppingers and their work from the New York Times. The links are at wordofmouthradio.org. That is all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow with more Word of Mouth at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.